Hey everybody, on this episode of AfterBuzz TV Spotlight On, we're getting up close and personal with actor Linda Park. Let's do it.
You're tuning into the destination for TV superfan discussion, AfterBuzz TV. And now, let the buzz begin.
Ooh, a nice little mellow intro from the Bosch.
A little series. Jazz.
There you go. Yes, look at that. For the Amazon series here, I'm one of your, welcome to AfterBuzz TV Spotlight On. Of course, this is the show where we get up close and personal with the people both in front and behind the camera that bring you all that great entertainment that you can see on your television set, in the movie theater, or even on your mobile streaming devices. I'm your host, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. Now, my guest today, she has boldly gone where few people have gone before in two different areas. One, as an actress, she's been in a film and television such as Jurassic Park 3, Star Trek Enterprise, Rain, Castle, CSI, NCIS,
Murder
The Mentalist.
Club, yes, the Crash, yes. On Stars.
There you go. But also, she is a Bronze Medal International Ballroom Dancer.
Everyone always brings this, like, yes. A different life. Well, it was pro-am. It was when I was in high school. I was obsessed with ballroom because of that. Remember that movie, Strictly Ballroom?
Yes.
It was all because of Strictly Ballroom. I tend to be someone when it comes to, like, physical things, like stage combat or ballroom dancing, where I go into a hobby, like, totally balls to the wall, and then I drop it.
With that little preamble, ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome Linda Park to the show. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So now you were born in Seoul, mm-hmm. And then how old were you when you moved here to the States?
I think it was like 2 years old, 2 or 3.
And yeah. Was it just was an opportunity for your parents to just, like, this is going to be a new life for us over here in the States?
Well, it was more like it was going to be a new life for me and my mom.
Okay.
Yeah, my mom left my dad for a spell with me and came to America to live with my grandma, my aunt, who lived in this tiny apartment in Milpitas. So for the first many years of my life, it was me, my grandma, my aunt, my mom, and we were all in this tiny apartment together. And the first time I met my dad, I think I was in kindergarten. He came back, and my parents got back together,
mm-hmm.
And he came to America shortly thereafter. But I was raised in a house full of women. My mom, my grandma, and I all slept in one bed together, and for some reason, my aunt got her own bed. I don't know, maybe she was spoiled, but yeah, I would just, like, sleep tucked between my grandma and my mom, and...
It was interesting, because I feel like when you have those kind of new family dynamics, I remember when my parents... divorced, that and we're moving into a new apartment with my, mm-hmm. my mother and my sister. Even she was like, you know, your sister and I will just take one room and let you have the other. But it didn't end up happening that way. But the fact that she thought that was like, okay. All right, I'll do that. It's like, why are you giving this to me? I don't need a whole
probably
room.
Probably because you were, like, just the boy.
The only boy,
right? So yeah. How did it work out? It was like...
Just me and my sister shared the room and my mom met her on, which I think is the smartest thing to do.
Makes a little more
yeah,
sense.
Absolutely. That's the right way to go. So has acting always been something you've been drawn to, or is there some kind of event in your life that said, like, you know what, this is something I'd really like to pursue?
I think the event was probably loneliness. I don't remember a time that I didn't want to be an actor. I grew up as an only child. I didn't speak English very well for a while, my first years in America. I remember being in kindergarten, preschool, and having such difficulty and really being made fun of because I couldn't communicate, not only with other kids, but with the teachers. And so I'd always just play pretend. And somehow I found this, like, rinky-dink community theater in Milpitas called Rainbow Theater, and it was for little kids, and we did, like, Phantom Tollbooth and Little Mermaid and Meet Me in St. Louis, and my mom has no idea how I found that theater. Being, like, a Korean woman who didn't even speak English, the last thing she wanted was her daughter to be an actor. She wanted me to be something that was going to make me money. you know, because we were, growing up, we were just dirt poor. And so it's kind of one of those magical, like, universe, may sound new agey, it was just a gift given me to survive probably, like, a really... challenging upbringing. And here's a fact people don't know about me too often, is I was a very troubled teen, and I almost got sent to juvie, And I got into a lot of fights. Especially in junior high. And it was really my love of theater that saved me and got me a community where I felt, and you hear the story a lot where people, either if they're gay or they don't fit in or they're, you know, just are odd in some way, find a community where they're accepted in the arts, where they don't find it with necessarily the normal, quote unquote normal, you know, cool kids in school.
Now, your mother, even though she may have been reluctant to see you kind of embrace that kind of career track, when she saw what that was doing for you, just like growing in high school and stuff, was she more supportive of that, or was she always...
No. She was like, listen, it's really hard for an Asian person. You're not going to make it as an actress because you're Asian. And I had the kind of personality that... I just thrived in the underdog, and I think I still do, is that when someone tells me that I can't do something, I just see red and I say I will do it. And it wasn't until I got Star Trek right after drama school, actually, that... and the only reason my mom let me go to drama school was I was a horrible student. And I didn't get very good grades, but I got accepted to all the drama schools that I applied to, except for Juilliard. But she let me go because at least it was an education. I'm painting a really bad picture of me as a teen. Like, I get bad grades, no one likes getting in fights. I was complicated. I think hopefully that will be helpful to people who feel like they struggle in school or feel like they're just not being successful at the things that the world prescribes as successful, you know. And it wasn't until I got Star Trek that my mom suddenly was like, oh, my daughter's an actress. I'm so proud of you. And because being able to make money is, in a lot of the Asian cultures, a real sign of success. Maybe a lot of people have that, not just Asian cultures, but it comes from a lot of parents not wanting their children to suffer, and especially immigrant parents having sacrificed so much to give their children opportunity that they didn't have, that there's this feeling of they want their children to maximize on the possibilities. And while my mom was scared that I wouldn't maximize on my possibilities, I, you know, thankfully, by the grace of the universe, did. And so she's really proud now. She's really proud.
That is awesome to hear. Because I've imagined growing up, that is such a... I mean, especially being a teenager, such a challenging time where you have parents' expectations, you know, friends' expectations, the mm-hmm. school's expectations, your wants, desires, dreams, mm-hmm. and all those are kind of just meshing together. And it's not an easy course to navigate. There's a lot of things pulling on you.
Yeah. I think that still happens now. I think we don't ever outgrow that kind of pull between. The essence of what it is that we want to do in life, whether it's to create or to love well or to make people happy. There's these pure ambitions. And then there's all the stuff like, am I the best at what I do? Is that other person better than me? Am I liked enough? Am I good enough? There's all these other kind of opinions that actually... kind of sully what is our original pure kind of love of doing something, especially now with we're talking about social media, and social media is a beautiful thing, but it can also be total compare and despair. It can be, people can fall down the rabbit hole of, and I think everyone, even the biggest movie stars or Pulitzer Prize winners can relate to this, that feeling of, this person is doing better than me. Why don't I have this award? Or why don't I have this level of acclaim? Or, and it's a deep, I think, a deep sense, and we're getting really deep here, but a deep sense of there's not enough, like a lack of abundance. And I think the more that I address that for myself and go, actually, there is enough. Like, I do have enough. There is, you know, we get so caught in that we don't have enough when the reality is we have more than what we need. If we just look around and wake up, we're so abundant. We're so blessed. And, you know, that's just my two cents on that.
Well, how do you handle that with social media? Do you, because I know some people who have that same kind of thought dial back from Facebook or any of the social media. It's like, you know, I'm just going to dial it back so I don't have to worry about coming in, seeing those things and having those feelings maybe come up. Do you, or people are like recognize that that is like something they have to just look past and they will still embrace all social media, just knowing that that's something like, all right, I can easily let that go if somebody else is doing something and not let it affect how I'm seeing myself.
Yeah, I think both those things are important. I think that having social media cleanses are important, you know, as I try to do with my diet twice a year, is just really give my body a break and let my digestive system, doesn't mean fasting or anything like that, just means I think everyone kind of does this once in a while, whether they call it a diet or they call it a cleanse or they just call it a reset. I think doing that with social media is just important too. I usually find the holidays are a really good time because there's no work pressing. And, but that said, social media is such a big part of a lot of our, you get this, it's a part of your work. Mm-hmm. You have to be plugged in. You have to, like, I have to promote the projects that I'm doing right now. I want to promote the projects that I'm doing right now. And so it's become, a real exercise for me to say, all right, this is a challenge for me to stay plugged in and then not fall down the hole of how many people like this, how far is the reach going out, or how is the can I share something and can I leave it, you know, can I not fall into the hole of then like looking and that if I do see someone that I feel has gotten a part that I wanted or something like that, like, can I use that as a moment instead of having all those feelings come up and saying, oh, I don't want to feel that, I don't want to feel that, just go, oh, I'm feeling jealous right now, and I'm feeling just, I think the more we all just get back in touch with where we're reacting from, what our feelings are, instead of just diving back into our thumbs. Like, look at it, have your feelings, take a second, and then just, that's the only way we're going to evolve with our gadgets, mm-hmm. is if we stay conscious with our gadgets and start to become like the master and not the slave, right? It's like a Jedi mind thing.
Well, it's definitely something I feel like with wisdom and life experience, easier to have that kind of mindset. But certainly going back to a teenager, when you don't have that kind of life experience or maturity yet, mm-hmm. it's so much easier to fall down that and feel that your self-worth just relies on what everybody else values you at, instead of like what comes from yourself.
And hopefully you have really good friends and really good human beings and not gadgets in your life that you can even that out with. And then I think if there are feelings of, especially for like people who are younger and who don't have that yet, I can almost guarantee that if they talk about a certain feeling, whether it be feeling not pretty enough, not skinny enough, not cool enough, not accomplished enough, instead of trying to pretend like those feelings aren't there, have a bitch fest with your friend and express your feelings and say, and then, you know, and then you can just get it out there. You can just get it out there instead of sitting on all these feelings of not enoughness and not, and that's so isolating. And that can, you know, that feeling of a feeling that I'm not cool enough. Why is this person's life better? I'm so sad. I'm so lonely. You know.
Well, when you finished drama school, and you're saying one of the first, your first job out of there was Star Trek Enterprise.
Yeah.
And so that is just not necessarily just a show, but you're also entering into this huge fandom. It has been around since the original series premiered back in the late 60s.
Yeah.
So that right there, just does that, do you feel the pressure of that as you get onto that series, having that huge fan base that is there to be supportive, but then also can be very critical?
Mm-hmm. I don't feel as much of the pressure now. When it happened, I felt a lot of pressure. And I was 21, 22. And there are dolls being made of you. There are people coming up to you talking about stalker protection. This is like on set. This woman, she was like, I've helped other cast members deal with stalkers and fans, and you know, and then there's just all of a sudden the first episode hadn't aired and I was getting tons of fan mail, just tons of fan mail, and then one person that ended up being like slightly stalkerish, and he'd never even seen an episode, he just saw pictures of me. And so it made me really kind of not trust a little bit, because I had so much coming at me. But now I think I'm able to separate. I'm so grateful for the fans. I'm so grateful for now in retrospect that the series has been now re-released on Netflix. There's a whole new generation of Star Trek fans. Like when I go to Star Trek conventions, my favorite is when I see parents with their little kids, and their little kids just like are legitimately wide-eyed, and they go, they've watched all the Enterprise series now on Netflix, and all these young generations of kids who their parents have, you know, given their love of Star Trek to the kids, and then I see kind of the beauty of the family that I'm a part of, that we're American mythology, you know, iconic America is as iconic as you can get. It's something that will probably be the one of the major things that my grandkids, my great grandkids will refer to, you know, me as an actress in my life as, and I love the message of Star Trek. I really love, especially in current times. And there was a whole faction of, and this is getting not personal, but like real. There is a whole, I was a big Hillary supporter, and I was and am very anti-Trump. And there's a whole part of a huge part of Star Trek followers that hate Hillary, that have are huge Trump, you know, supporters. And so I came up across a lot of hate, but hate talk against feminists, you know, calling me a dirty feminist, calling me, you know, another stupid progressive artist. And that kind of talk was so upsetting to me. And what I had to stand on was, you're entitled to your opinion 100%. But if you're attacking me in any way for being anti-Trump and also being a Star Trek person, I stand, if you look at everything that Star Trek stands for, what Gene Roddenberry really was kind of proposing to mankind, to say, listen, we need to all work together. We are one kind. And he was so progressive in his casting that made it possible for George and, you know, Nichelle and myself and Rosalind and all these people who never had a chance to be on TV to be on TV. And even when I started on Star Trek, there was like Lucy Liu.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of people to look at. And now it's so great. It's so the thing. Right, diversity, and that's another thing of itself. But you know, it's. I don't even know how we got on.
Well, because one of the big things about that was like the whole IDIC, like the infinite diversity and infinite combinations. That was just always just like right there in the framework of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And so, I can see how frustrating it is to. Why would you want to stand behind somebody that doesn't feel that way and supports that? Like, if you support this message, then why can you not see that this is, we should all be working together?
Yeah. And then on that equal, on the other side of that coin, I was proud of so many Star Trek fans who reiterated that message and who felt exactly the way that I did, saying that this is what Star Trek was about. That about inclusivity, about the importance of you know, of diversity, but mostly that idea of inclusivity, of us as one race together, you know, mankind, and not separating it like this person is black and this person is, you know, when dealing with Sulban and Klingon and, you know, that you don't, it becomes just very pure, and that it's mankind. And even in that vision, there is this idea of reaching out to not make war, reaching out to unify. That was always, you know, Enterprise never went out there and said, we're going to start a war and take over a planet. It was to communicate, to, and that idea of go where no man has gone before is on a metaphoric, the way that Star Wars is like that, on a metaphoric level. Like, let's evolve. Let's go where no man has gone before. Let's evolve who we are. And, you know, you have the Vulcans as that, who they no longer have war. But it was a real push for our greatest human potential, and that lied in communication, in wanting to bring together in peace, or in the pursuit of peace. And of course, there's lots of like battles and fun guns and all of that in, you know, in the meantime. But that is the essential message, you know, and that's why I'm drawn to ultimately Star Trek and Star Wars, is that kind of mythological, Odyssean, you know, it's our modern day myths.
Were you interested in that, in the series, before you actually started performing on the show? Or, like, had you seen the movies and watched the TV shows but never really had gotten, like, become, like, a Trekkie or Trekker?
Right. I mean, I wasn't a Trekkie, but I think you have to be living under a rock or on a farm to not have any knowledge of Star Trek. My knowledge of Star Trek was Next Generation, because when I was growing up, there wasn't any really... When I was young, there was no cable, so there was, you know, you had your couple of channels, mm-hmm. and Next Gen was on all the time. It was, like, really popular, obsessed with the holodeck. I loved that show, and I grew up on that show, and then it kind of went out of my mind as I grew up and went on to watch different television.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But still, when that happened, when I got Star Trek, it was still that, oh, shit. This is, the hugeness of it was not lost on me or anyone in my life.
Well, and of course, captaining it, I mean, you've got Scott Bakula.
Yeah.
So, I mean, already before he came on the show,
Quantum Leap.
Yes.
I grew up on Quantum Leap.
Yes,
I loved Quantum Leap.
As did I. So,
yeah.
Man, that. So, to have somebody like that to be kind of leading the team for the first TV show that you're working on, that must have been a great experience.
Yeah. I mean, it was the first of many. Weird, like 10-year-old Linda, and then, you know, grown up Linda having this moment of, it's very normal. I'm in this scene with this person, but then every so often I would go into my like 10 or 11 or 12-year-old self and go, oh my gosh, remember when you had such a crush on him and you loved that show? And, you know, it's happened like a couple of times where I'm working with someone that when I was younger seemed just in a different realm, in this world of Hollywood, in this world of the magic of television and movies. And then when you find yourself acting with them, it's normal, and then it's also very bizarre. It's normal because it's your job, and it's also very bizarre because your young self is freaking out. Yeah.
And I've had the chance to interview Anthony Montgomery.
Yeah,
one of the co-stars. What a man, a suave gentleman.
Such a nice,
yes.
nice guy.
It's so does the cast still stay in touch? I mean, I guess when you're doing these conventions, you do keep
doing
some things together.
Yeah, we see each other. Anthony and I see each other. Connor and I see each other sometimes. Brandon and I see each other. John. Pretty much I see everyone, you know, at conventions. But the last time we all got together was for the DVD Behind the Scenes, where we all sat and we did that interview, and that was just so great. It was so great for us all just to reconnect, and they will always be... There are a couple of people from other shows, you know, Laura Harris from Women's Murder Club or Ross McCall from Crash, who are still in my life, and I still am friends with them. But pretty much all the other shows, you know, you move on, and during the show you felt like, oh, we're family, and then you move on. But with the Enterprise cast, pretty much everybody... it is like family. It is. It really is. We don't see each other as often as we'd like, but I have such a special place in my heart for all of them, and I think they all feel that way, too, about me and about each other, and, you know...
Well, certainly, I guess you read the stories of the original series, some friction between the cast, but yeah. From Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise, it seems like those casts really are fond of each other. They've just really locked in and really become just really close friends.
Yeah, I mean, we also used to say, oh, we're a lot like TNG, you know, because a lot of them came back to direct or be on the show, you know, Brent, Michael, Jonathan, Marina, and I had... done a movie with Marina, and so we became close, and then I had done I had some mutual people with Michael, so Michael and I became friends, and Brent and I did some things together, and he and I just did a reading together. So even though there's that, you know, if we're the freshmen and they were the seniors or the juniors, I guess the seniors would be the original TOS.
Oh, sure, yep.
Right. That's the class that we really got close with, and I'm still very close with Voyager people. Or Jerry, we had the same agent for a good while, and her and I became good friends. And then also Armin Shimmerman and I are in the same theater company where I'm doing a show now, and so Armin and I are very, very close, and he is one of the most loveliest human beings on the face of the earth.
To ask just one question about Enterprise.
Yeah.
The last episode, I always felt like I was let down for the fact that so much of it seemed to be focused on TNG with Riker kind of going back onto the holodeck. Yeah. And you guys were just, I felt like this is your final episode for the series. I wanted the focus to be on you guys and not being explored through a holodeck kind of flashback.
Everybody felt that way. Everybody did. I mean, I know there was a lot of tension on set. I know Scott had really strong feelings about it. I had strong feelings about it. I think most of the cast had really strong feelings about it. And I think from the talk that we had in the behind the scenes, I think Brannon also has regrets about it and would have done it differently. You know, you make mistakes all the time creating. And it's one of those things that, like, I do wish that we could have had a one-off of just, like, redoing that one.
Yeah.
You know, just redoing that one. But we have so many other great episodes and so many great memories, and we're all off living our lives, doing great work. So
now, certainly, while you've moved on, the novelizations, the books, they will continue on with the Enterprise characters. Have you ever gone and read any of those novelizations to kind of continue the story past?
I haven't. There's been a couple written about Hoshi, and I've wanted to read them, but I've had no time. So but I think that's really cool. I think it's really cool because Hoshi doesn't, you know, she doesn't belong to me. Like, I gave her a voice and a face and a heart and what I could with my instrument. And now it's a beautiful thing that as I've moved on, I've, like, hot potatoed her to these people who allow her to live on and in perpetuity in these novels. And I say, keep writing them, you know, like, let her do amazing things. Let her do all the things that you wish she could have done on the show.
And speaking of Star Trek, one other thing you did was the Captain Pike film as well, TV. So it's where you played as a movie, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. That was, that I'm not sure if it's supposed to be a movie or a TV show or a pilot. I'm not sure. There were, I think there were some friends. There's Ray Wise did it, and Bruce, not Bruce Dern. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, shoot.
Bruce, he's an X-Men. He's
yes.
great.
Yes, Bruce, I'm going to say not Pat Patterson. But
you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, yes.
Oh, it's going to kill me.
I know.
Anyways, and so that was kind of more like, I think, like a pilot presentation for him to do a series. I have no idea where the state of that is. You know, you do so many of these things, like whether it be for people doing an indie movie or whatever project, and you kind of, after you do your work, you kind of just let it go and see what happens to it.
Well, that's not always the case with stuff that you've done. You did Adoptable.
Yes.
Which,
yes.
Crowdsourced to get the funding for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are the challenges of crowdsourcing? Did you find that? Is it an incredibly difficult thing to achieve?
Well, it wasn't me. It was my very dear friend, Scott Lowell, who he was on Queer as Folk for... I forget his character's name on Queer as Folk, but he is a wonderful actor, such a good writer, and he got such an amazing cast together, and Noah Wiley, Eddie Jemison, Eddie Jemison may be one of the most funny human beings that I've, like, had the... And he's such a type. You know Eddie Jemison, mm-hmm. right? And so we all just got to do this hilariously funny and sad and... quirky web series. He crowdfunded it, but lost a huge majority of it to taxes. So that, to me, seems like that was the biggest challenge in that, is that he didn't realize how much was going to be lost to taxes. So people don't realize that and I don't think he realized the magnitude of that either. But I think he was in talks with a couple places, and it's still out there, and I've gotten to see it, and it is it's so good. It's really good, and it's based on his experiences of being adopted.
Yeah, so I understand, and the premise is, like, now as an adult, he wants to go and find his birth parents.
Yeah, and it kind of spoofs, because he was a Queer as Folk, this obviously gay show, and Scott himself is not gay. And in this show, it's a fictional version of himself. His name is Scott, but his character plays this famously gay cop on the show called Cops and Bottoms. and so he's kind of having this existential crisis as he's on this horrible procedural, and his crime partner is, you know, this is Noah Wiley, who plays Noah, but he plays himself, but, you know, just a womanizing, egotistical version of himself, hilarious. And he has this kind of existential crisis of wanting to find his parents, and then it's based on Scott's search for his own real life adopted parents and all the twists and turns, and I play the documentarian that, you know, that we're doing this together, and it's... Hopefully, you know, it gets seen. I think it's really worthwhile for people to see.
Now, one other person you also shared the screen with was Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah, yeah.
That man is just so interesting.
The most interesting man on earth. They should have a tequila for, like...
for a man that plays music, I mean, he acts.
Yeah, jazz.
Directs, yes.
Yeah, jazz pianist.
Have you gone to see him, watch him perform live?
I did when we were in the show together, and he's just got... the perfect personality for it too. He's of a different time, either way far in the future or way long ago. You can't tell, you know. That's why he's just got such a, and it's authentic. Oftentimes that kind of personality is like a put on thing. It's like it's a thing. You know, Gilbert Godfrey is a very normal guy. Right.
Yes.
But Jeff is Jeff. 100%. And I haven't seen him in the longest time, but we had the best time on the show. He is probably one of the most charming charming humans I've met. There's something very just innocent and childlike, and I think that's wonderful for an artist to always maintain that kind of sense of awe and sense of wonder with a splash of mischief, or five splashes of mischief in Jeff's case. But yeah, and that was another scenario like Scott, where I was like, I can't believe that I'm sitting here with Jeff Goldblum, because I grew up watching all Jeff Goldblum movies. You know, all of his cult classics.
Oh, that's so... Now, for you, starting off from drama school, even with going to Star Trek Enterprise, to going up to Reigns with Jeff Goldblum,
Yeah. Are
you pretty much just like a sponge on the set, just kind of just watching these actors that you've admired and just picking out, like, you know, bits and pieces and techniques that they do and just kind of incorporating it to yourself? Or Have you been pretty much just, I'm just doing my own thing, I have my own kind of way of looking at this and approaching the material, and I'm just going to kind of go off and do my own?
You know, if someone does something really interesting and I notice something about their process and I'm watching the monitor and I'm seeing it really works, I get intrigued and I dive in to see what that is, because I'm always up for new modalities, and like I will steal openly people's methods. You know, if they're doing something really interesting on, and I've done this with partners who I think with boyfriends, or you know, that I think have really great, that's something on screen, I'll start to see like what is their process, and I'll kind of, and it's, you know, I always remember this, I forget which Nightmare on Elm Street it was, but it was the one where in order to finally fight Freddy, she had all her friends that Freddy had killed, she goes to them and she gets each of their strengths in the dream. Like, one's a bodybuilder, one is, like, super smart. But they all, even though they're dead in the dream world, they all give her their strength.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in the end, she's able to, like, defeat Freddy. And I remember watching that thinking, that is so cool. That is so cool. That's what, you know, because I never felt like I had any big, I did feel very much like that protagonist. But I thought, I'm a really good learner, and I'm a sponge, and you know, I think where I do that the most is in rehearsal, is I see, because then you're in most with somebody else's process on set. You don't really get to see a lot of people's process. It's in rehearsal when you really do. But yeah, stealing's great.
Now, I was talking about television, mm-hmm. but we're also theater as well.
Yeah.
Currently, you're doing a production right now,
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
So, what's tackling Tennessee Williams?
Yeah.
Have you been an admirer of this play for a long time, or is this something like your way and you're like, sure, I'll take on the challenge?
No, I chased this. I chased this bad boy with everything I had in me. You know, we talked about my lonely childhood, right, or my troubled high school years, and I actually, they wrote this really great article in LA Weekly recently that just really wrote it so beautifully and expressed my journey with this, because I am the first Asian Maggie in a professional production, and growing up, I never thought that I could play this character that I had fallen in love with so deeply, because I was Asian. And the 1950s and Mississippi and Asian did not seem to go like that. And but the way that I found Cat on a Hot Tin Roof was this movie called Double Happiness with Sandra Oh. And first of all, I was so happy to see an Asian woman in a movie, even though it was an indie movie. I was like, oh, wow, it's working. My mom's wrong. It can happen. And It was about an actress who her parents didn't want her to be an actress, and she was fighting and struggling against them, and she had these scenes where she would be in her bedroom, and then they had this theatrical device where stage lights would come up, and she would do these monologues, and it was from Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And I related so deeply to that, and I love these monologues, so I went out and I found Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and I read it, and I put it down after I read it, and I was maybe like 15, and I cried for an hour. And for the rest of high school, whenever I'd be in my room, instead of playing pretend, I would just be doing this monologue. Maggie has an hour where she's talking almost completely by herself. She's talking to her alcoholic husband who doesn't respond, but it's almost 40 pages of straight dialogue. And so I had a lot of dialogue to play with, you know, as a 15-year-old. And then I just became such a lover of Tennessee Williams because he just understood two things so deeply: loneliness and the pain of not being able to communicate with the people that you love, how people that love each other hurt each other. And those things I understood very deeply. And he said this quote in the beginning of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof where he said he feels like with his art that, I'm paraphrasing, but we're all, our souls are all in the cages of our bodies, and art is the only way we cry out from one cage to another, to break that loneliness. And I was like, that's what I feel. That's what I feel when I watch a movie, you know, when I was like lonely and bullied and, you know, a lot of things going on. When I would watch a movie, or I would read a book, or I'd read a play, or I'd see a play, that's what he's talking about. The loneliness would fade, and I would feel like I'm not alone. I'm understood. Somebody else has put to voice what I am feeling, like, in my guts. And so that's just always been my reason to do what I do. And we talk about that, going back to our beginning of our conversation, to remember that pure ambition when the other shit gets caught up, like success.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So this production is beautiful. We've been getting rave reviews. And I actually went to the director who I'd done a show with before, and because I did a shit ton of research, because I thought, how can an Asian play Maggie? I must play Maggie. This is a director I know. This is, you know, my theater company. How can I? And everyone in the theater community in LA came out to audition for Maggie. It was something I was really nervous about. And turns out that there's a huge Chinese population in the Delta, and in Mississippi. They were known as the third race of the Mississippi. And there was a whole book based on where the Chinese fit into the binary black and white during Jim Crow segregation. And I read this book called Chopsticks in the Land of Cotton. And I suddenly felt like, you know what? I do belong in Cat on Hot Tin Roof. There was this whole underrepresented community in the South in the 1950s that never got plays written about them, never got movies written about them. Maggie is the outsider in Cat on Hot Tin Roof. She's fighting to stay in this family. You know, she's grown up poor. She's had a shit life. Like, if anyone's going to be Asian or can be Chinese. And, you know, and it's worked beautifully. There's this one line I say to Big Daddy, I say, and I love it because people spot it and they go, and it's written in the original where she says, Big Daddy's got on the Chinese slippers I gave him. And it's the Chinese slippers, you know, and it's something that we work with, and we never change, but it works so perfectly. And people come and see it and they go, I can't not see Maggie as Chinese. It's like, and that's a beautiful thing to me, to be able to retell a classic with the ghosts of people who never got a voice.
And that's got to be nice, to read that book and change, not necessarily that you're fearful or desperate to get this role, but just reading that book and seeing that those people that were underrepresented, mm-hmm. and just kind of changing the way that you're just approaching that, wanting to pursue that role.
It changed the way I pursue that role 100%. The spine of it is entirely now the issues I have with being an immigrant. of feeling like I've always had to fight to prove that I belong here, that there is a deep sense of, do I have a right to exist? Where do I belong? I don't belong in Korea. I do belong here. Damn it, I do belong here, you know? And so this imposter syndrome that many children of immigrants have, that immigrants have, has become my Maggie's imposter syndrome and her fight and her just feeling like she's a cat on a hot tin roof with nowhere to go except to claw her way and stay on, even though her like fingernails are burning from this, she has no other choice. It is based on my immigrant experience and what the kind of backstory I've given myself. And it gave me, for so long, I feel like, oh, I love this place so much, but it doesn't belong to me, you know, it belongs to white people in the South, you know, like O'Neill or, you know, Arthur Miller. And this history made me go, this does belong to me. This does. And it just made me have this strong sense of ownership that is so fierce. and I'm glad that I didn't find any of this out until right before I auditioned and got the part, because it's all fresh. It's all, you know.
So we've talked about meeting actors that you've kind of had crushes on as a child. But what's it like when you actually get to now be Maggie in reading lines that you, since the age of 15, had been practicing in your room, to be able to have, to almost crushing on something that you yourself were so passionate about as a 15-year-old?
Your problem. I, you know, that's because the headphones on the outside. I'm very smart. I'm a very smart person. So I still have those moments where I go, oh my God, I'm playing Maggie. But it never hits me when I'm on the stage. It never, because how I used to read the play as a 15-year-old, as an 18-year-old, and then as a 25-year-old, and then, you know, as it is, because of the rehearsal process and because of the research that I've done, it's become alive in a different way that I don't even correlate those. It's the idea of Maggie, but it's become so real that it never feels like what it was I was doing. The only thing that remains is the essence of the ache of the story, the visceral pain of the story. But all the ideas or thoughts that I had about what the play is or who she is have changed. And I do feel so incredibly grateful, though. I feel like this is the best role I've ever done in my life, hands down, artistically, performance-wise, anything, film, TV, movies, theater. This is, you know, like, put a fork in me. I was like,
that's it. All right, Linda Park's out now. That's it. She's done. She's walking off into the sunset after this wraps. That's it.
Yeah. Did you guys get that on tape? I hope so.
Now, one other show that you have coming up here is April 21st, mm-hmm. Bosch Season 3.
Yeah.
Comes out on Amazon, streaming out for the third season there. You are joining the cast.
Yeah.
So how excited are you to be coming on? You're playing, let me just double check, CRT.
June Park.
Yes.
Yeah.
So were you a fan of the novels, or is this more of the cast? There's like, I'm excited to play with these people.
I'm not a big crime novel person. I only kind of read them when I have a like for Rains, we read a lot of kind of the Maltese Falcon and all of that noir, because that's what kind of the show was based on. And then Women's Murder Club is James Patterson, so I read it. But I don't really read that kind of thing in my own life. But I know so many people who are obsessed Michael Connelly fans, and just say, like, this man keeps churning out all these books, but how does he come up with all these ideas? And like, how? And they're always, you know, page turners, and you have to have real respect for that ability to constantly create out of your own mind these elaborate thrillers and schemes and personalities and inner lives and inner struggles too, which is a beautiful thing about Bosch, is that it's about the crime, but it's about this, it's about your protagonist's inner demons, you know, in a lot of ways. And but I was a huge fan of the show. I'm a huge fan of streaming, period. So Netflix, Amazon. I was a huge fan of Amazon. Transparent was one of the best shows mm-hmm. that I had seen in ages on television. It was so inspiring to me about what's possible do you call it television, right?
I guess.
Call it like streaming or...
But it just feels like there's a lot less restrictions, things that you can tell that you probably could not tell on a network television show.
Yeah, yeah. It feels a lot like, I mean, I didn't grow up in the 70s, but I watched a lot of movies from the 70s, like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and, you know, all the Pacino movies. And there was this kind of, after this whole Americana, like, smiley face, like, movies that happened, there's something that just had kind of happened in acting and film that exploded in the 70s of this, everything got real. Everything got really real. It's kind of happening in Korea right now with cinema because there's been less restrictions. And so there's been this big blast of a lot of darkness, but a lot of creativity. And that's what I feel like is happening with streaming. Is that there's this, without kind of this restriction, there's this like, and it's happening on cable too, like HBO and Showtime and all of this, but Bosch was something that I was such a fan of, a season when my husband and I both, because he loves thrillers, you know, like The Killing, and, you know, we're into Broadchurch mm-hmm. now. But I was so excited to join this cast because it's kind of storytelling that I like. It's elegant. It's not over the head. It's not, it's about, and it's also very true. Like, it's one of the most, my husband says this, he says it's one of the most legit cop shows. Like, it's what it's really like. It's not, you know, very, it's not networky or anything like that. That it's very legit. And then kind of being on set and talking to them, they're very, very adamant of it being very true to the LAPD. And I love seeing Los Angeles. I love seeing real Los Angeles. You know, going all around downtown or Koreatown and Silver Lake and Hollywood. And it's in the same way Rains was, had it been able to go longer. Rains was a real love letter to Los Angeles. And Bosch is that way, too.
Where you feel like you're really getting to see the city. It's not like you're just doing a couple Passover shots and then you're in a soundstage somewhere in Vancouver or something. You're really in the city, shooting, yeah. seeing, feeling it right there as you're shooting it.
Yeah, yeah. I really feel like, I mean, pretty much almost all the stuff that I've shot has been on location. I know that they have the precinct stuff set up on stages, but everything else, the majority was on location. And I love being on location, maybe because I've been on sound stages so long that locations, there's something that's just very urgent. First mm-hmm. of all, you have to get out.
Sure,
you know,
yep.
you know, there's something very exciting about being amidst real people and not blocked away from people on a set where you need a pass to get on. It's much more alive.
And you get, I see from the a lot of the scenes of the stills that they send over mm-hmm. with Lance Reddick.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, what a cool guy.
He's such a cool guy and the nicest guy. I was a little bit nervous because from all his roles, I thought he'd be very austere.
Mm-hmm.
But he's so generous and humble and a little shy and this very adorable... I mean, adorable is probably not a nice way. Very, very shy in this very endearing, way. So there's something about him that it was so easy for me to have this like chemistry with him because I do really, really enjoy him as a person.
Linda, I wish we could keep talking more.
Yes. It was great.
But Kettle on High Tin Roof, how much longer does it run?
We run till May 7th with a possible extension to May 21st.
Awesome.
I think we'll get extended. So please come and see. Everyone come and see at Antaeus Theater in our new beautiful theater space home in Glendale.
Awesome. And Bosch Season 3 debuts on Amazon April 21st. And if they want to follow everything else that you're doing otherwise, where can they find you on social media?
I am on Twitter.
Yes. We talk about the greatness of social
media. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
At Real Linda Park. And Instagram is Real Linda Park as well. So follow me, check me out, see what I'm up to.
Awesome, everybody. Thanks for joining us here for this episode of AfterBuzz TV Spotlight On. I've been your host, Frank Moran. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at HappyGoJackie. We'll see you next time right here on AfterBuzz TV.
Executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff. We would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV Network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Bye. Bye.
The views expressed herein are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.